This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ben Bradley is one of the most celebrated newspaper editors of our time. Bradley was the executive editor of the Washington Post from 1968 to 91. The biggest story covered under his watch was Watergate, the story that forced the resignation of President Nixon. It doesn't get much bigger than that. In a recent New Yorker profile, Bradley was described as guiding the Post with the most exquisitely tuned set of nerve endings in the business. He arrived at a mediocre paper, and with publisher Katharine Graham's money and support, made it great. Now Bradley has written his autobiography, called A Good Life, that also covers some of the not-so-good parts of his career, like printing Janet Cook's fabricated feature story. The first really big chance Bradley took was publishing the Pentagon Papers, the top-secret documents that told the history of the U.S. decision-making process on Vietnam. The New York Times had already published several installments, but the Justice Department got an injunction against the Times, preventing it from publishing further excerpts. Then the Pentagon Papers were leaked to the Post. I asked Bradley why he wanted the Post to publish them.
Failure to publish after the New York Times had published would have relegated the Post to a status of a kind of a pro-government establishment organization, which didn't want to take on the government, didn't want to fight for its constitutional rights. And it seems to me it would have forever relegated us to sort of second-class citizenship. It wasn't my decision. I wanted to publish from day one, moment one. It was Katharine Graham's decision, and it was a great decision, and it made all future decisions of an editorial nature at the Washington Post kind of automatic and easy.
Well, what were the risks?
Well, there were some interesting risks because if we had been, this was a civil suit, if we had been enjoined, and mind you, no newspaper in the history of the country, which was then 190-some years old, had ever been stopped from publishing something it wanted to publish beforehand, prior restraint. So that was a wonderful principle to fight for. The other thing is that if we had been convicted of that, if the judge had stopped us from publishing something, the Nixon administration was, it was quite obvious, was going to go after us on criminal violations, violating the code against publishing confidential and national security matters. If had we been convicted of that, you cannot own television stations if you are a convicted felon, and that would have been a felony. And we had about $100 million of television stations that we would have lost. The Post had just gone public in the New York Stock Exchange. Shares in the Post were offered for sale for the first time to the public, and that was seriously threatened. So it was no casual decision that was involved.
What did your lawyers have to say?
Well, the lawyers were great, really. They all argued initially against publishing, but understood our points. The legal voice that we listened to most was came from a man called Fritz Beebe, who was really had been a Wall Street lawyer and had joined the Washington Post company as president. And when he finally made his recommendation, he made it so cautiously and hedged it so much that he thought, on balance, maybe we better not print. It was easy for Katharine to say, "Let's go."
There's a great story you tell about a phone call that I think really took a lot of chutzpah to get to get a friend of yours who was a judge on the phone so you could get his advice. But of course, he was arguing a case in court at the time. Tell us what you did.
Well, he wasn't a judge; he was a
lawyer. I mean, a lawyer. I meant a lawyer.
It was Edward Bennett Williams, who was the famous defense attorney and a friend of mine for already 20 years. And he was, he would have defended us had he been in Washington, but he was trying a case in Chicago. I called up the editor of the Chicago Sun-Times, Jim Hoag, and said, "I need to get a message to Edward Bennett Williams in such and such a courthouse immediately." And the message was, "Please call me, urgent." And in a matter of minutes, Williams called me back. And I talked for about 12 minutes and said, "This is what we've got. This is what we want to do. these are the documents, this is what the New York Times has done, this is what the court, it was First Circuit in New York, had enjoined them from, and we want to publish, and I want you to tell me whether you think we should and why. And he sort of was silent for a split second, a split minute, and finally said, you've got to publish it. You've just got to do it. Because it wasn't in a sense of Plessy versus Ferguson that we had the right to blah, blah, blah. But he just sensed in his guts that to become an important player in the American scene, we had to do it. And I think that was enormously influential with Catherine Graham to help her make up her mind, because she admired Williams so much, as we all did.
So how much of the decision to publish was so that the Post could become a more respected player? And how much of it was all the lofty principles about freedom of the press?
That's a good question, too, because, in the last, it was 7,000 pages, although we only had 4,000 of them. We got them at 10:30 in the morning, and we published at 10:30 that night. Our first story. No one ever read the Pentagon Papers. They really didn't, you know. We could only read, each of us read sections of it. Then we, for about 8 hours, we read and then had a news conference and decided what we could publish. What mystified us all was that the Pentagon Papers ended with matters. And the decision-making process in Vietnam before President Nixon took office. And therefore, he was talking about the Johnson administration and the Kennedy administration and the Eisenhower administration. That's what the Pentagon Papers were about. I think, it dealt with the origins of the most important event in the middle of the 20th century. And therefore, it had an intrinsic importance to it. But we also, it was a principle that is really fundamental to a free press. We've got to be able to publish what we want, then get punished if we did wrong, then get pursued privately by people that we may have libeled or publicly for violating the law.
Getting back to the question, how much do you think your decision was based on making the Washington Post a player, and how much was based on the loftier principles of freedom of the press?
Well, we wanted to be a player, that's for sure. And we felt that we wouldn't be if we didn't publish. So it was an important factor, a very important factor. It was not probably the overriding one. The overriding one that we had a news story. We had a news story, and that's what we're in business to do, publish it.
Now, give me a sense of what your style was like when you were making your case to Catherine Graham and to the lawyers. Did you make speeches about freedom of the press? Did you insult your opponents in the newsroom? What was your style?
No, I had no opponents in the newsroom. I had the lawyers to worry about.
The lawyers, yeah, okay.
All of this was taking place in my house in Georgetown, and we had two fairly large rooms. In one of them was sort of a temporary city room where a bunch of reporters and a couple of news aides and a copy editor or two were actually reading the documents, making up their mind what story to run, what story could they get into shape to run that night. And in the other room, we had the lawyers and the representatives of the owners and a couple of editors from the editorial page. And I shuttled between the two, trying to make up my mind and learn the content, and then trying to steer the conversation to the verdict I wanted. There was no point in trying to say we've got to do it and threaten to quit, because then even if you won that, you'd win it leaving a great scars and wounds in personal relationships. So we had to do it sort of gently and listen to everybody and listen to their arguments and try to understand them and then try to counter them.
You said the decision to publish the Pentagon Papers made all other difficult decisions easy at the Washington Post. How?
Well, because we turned out to have been right.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court agreed with us that we had the right to publish. I think, I'm speaking for Catherine Graham, but I think she felt that we had given her good advice. We'd asked her to do what turned out to be the right thing. And so to publish or not to publish never became an issue. She trusted our judgment in these things. I mean, sometimes she may have held her breath, but she thought that these people are really serious about journalism, serious about a principle, and not reckless.
Now, do you thrive on making these complicated decisions, or were these like Malox moments for you? You'd be reaching for the medicine chest, reaching for the medicine.
Well, this wonderful quality of journalism, if you make a mistake, it's out there for everybody to see.
Yeah.
And it stays there, and, you know, it goes right bang into the history books, and it's there are no known device that you can erase a daily newspaper. I love it. Yeah, I do love the sense that you're dealing with important issues and that you're going to be fair and you're going to be honest, but you're not going to back down.
No headaches, ulcers, upset stomachs?
I never had an ulcer. The guy, my doctor once told me, you'll never have an ulcer, Bradley.
Well, good for you.
And I never have.
Ben Bradley is my guest, former executive editor of The Washington Post, now author of a new memoir called A Good Life. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ben Bradley, he's written a new memoir called A Good Life. Well, let's move on to Watergate. What was the first sign that your reporters were onto something pretty spectacular?
Well, let's start with five Spanish-speaking persons in the Democratic National Committee wearing dark glasses, rubber gloves, and carrying walkie-talkies and crisp new $100 bills in their pocket at 2 o'clock in the morning. That's what got our attention. You'd have to be lobotomized not to see that that was interesting. In a matter of a day, we knew that one of them had a CIA and a White House connection. And in a matter of 2 weeks, we knew that that money came from a political gift to the committee to reelect President Nixon. At which point, you know, you couldn't have turned back if you'd tried. There was too much left to unexplained. And the more you dug into it, the more there was to explain, and the weaker the explanations became.
What was your technique for checking the information that Woodward and Bernstein gave you?
Well, we drove them crazy with our you know, demands for explanations of where did you get this, and it was then that instituted this so-called two-source rule, where we had to have at least two independent sources for information that they got. They tried a few shortcuts in the beginning on that when we suddenly found that of their two sources of information, one of them had received the information from the first source, so that it really still was only one source of information. But, I mean, if you read their books, they will tell you about how difficult Howard Simons, the managing editor, and Len Downey, who was now the executive editor, was then the Metropolitan editor, were in forcing them to explain everything.
What were you afraid would go wrong? Like, what was the worst thing that could have happened?
Well, I thought that, here's what I thought, and increasingly, that it was going to end up in some kind of a desultory tie. There would be people who believed in Nixon, who would end up concluding that the press had hounded him to death and that there was not much going on there anyway. Whereas on the other side, there were people led by this sort of feisty young Washington Post crowd that were baying at his heels in the middle of an election, and that a tie would really be damaging to the country because the truth would never emerge. And it wasn't, I think, until the tapes were the existence of the tapes were revealed that I felt that it wasn't going to end in a tie. It was going to end with a winner.
What was it like for the Post to cover the White House during Watergate? Well, did your sources there shut you out?
Yeah, they sure did. And the White House correspondent was Carol Kilpatrick, who is a gentle, really a brilliant journalist, a gentle man, though, and from Alabama. And we made his life tremendously difficult. And to be called, you know, to sit in the White House briefing room while Ziegler or whoever else it was called your paper liars and was very difficult. And some of the people calling you a liar there were politicians who held quite high office. One of them was Robert Dole, who's now running for president. He then was chairman of the Republican National Committee. Succeeded in early 1973 by George Bush, who went on to become president, as you know.
Now, you didn't know who Deep Throat was. You know who it is now, but you didn't know.
I didn't know until a year or two afterwards, when after Woodward and Bernstein published their second book, and people started whining about, you know, how come this man's identity was kept so secret. And I took Woodward out on a park bench in McPherson Square and said, the time has come for me to know. I had known generally where he worked and what kind of responsibilities he had and how high up he was in the pecking order. But I did not know his name until a couple of years later.
Why'd you choose the park bench to pop the question?
Well, in the city room, somebody would have been overhearing me, and we weren't all that sure that our phones weren't tapped.
Did he resist you?
Not at all. I mean, he said, yes, I understand, and he gave me the name.
If you were doing Watergate, the Watergate story today, would you insist on knowing who Deep Throat was before publishing?
Well, probably, yes. I'm not sure. I had such trust in Woodward, and because he had been, he's an extraordinary reporter, and he had, they'd produce the goods, you know. They just produced the goods. They weren't wrong. And in newspapers, the develops a bond of trust that's very strong when a reporter's information turns out to be true, always.
So why are you second-guessing that today? Today you're saying you probably would have...
Well, I got in trouble after that with not knowing if that's where you're headed. One person's Janet Cook, when she wrote a story that turned out to be a total fraud, I didn't know her her source then. And the editors hadn't, and I think I saw that coming. And now I said, well, let's just be sure that somebody in authority knows.
Is it hard to keep the Deep Throat secret? Does it ever get to you?
I mean, I haven't told a soul. I mean, a soul. I haven't told my wife. I have never told any of the Grahams because they have never asked me. And it's been remarkably easy to do. You have to be sure that you're ready for the question, but it always comes.
Right. Ben Bradley is my guest, former executive editor of The Washington Post, now author of a new memoir called A Good Life. You write that Watergate marked the final passage of journalism into the seats of the establishment, and that you began to feel subconsciously that what the world did not need right away was another investigation that might again threaten the foundations of democracy, and what the newspaper did not need right away was another fight to the finish with another president. So do you feel like you held back on certain stories?
Well, you know, I wrote that and meant to say that I think that was that was floating around in the caverns of my mind. It wasn't something that governed my actions or that I was conscious that governed my actions. But I think that, you know, that made the country tremble. And it was a constant for 2.5 years. Even your friends would occasionally say, are you sure this is going to be good for the country? And I was sure that it was going to be good for the country because I believe that the truth sets us all free and that we're better for knowing the truth, even if it's painful.
Tell us something about what it was like the day Nixon resigned for you.
Well, I had so much to do. This is a wonderful part of journalism there is never any time to say, boy, I feel good, boy, I feel bad, oh, my God, I want to go out and celebrate, or, oh, I want to go and grieve. You have an awful lot to do. In our case, we were pretty sure that he was going to resign, but we didn't know he was going to resign. We had a 20-page extra section ready to go, describing the Nixon years, we had the most important, complicated, difficult story to write about how come he resigned, when he resigned. And it was vitally important that that be written fairly, gracefully, and with intelligence. And we didn't want to make a silly damn mistake the last day after on a story that we had spent, close to 30 months on of our lives. And it really, consumed our lives. That's what we did. We did Watergate.
You didn't have print large enough for the size headline you wanted for
That's
Nixon
right.
Resigns.
We had to print it in the largest type we had, and then enlarge that so that it would fill out the eight, which was then an 8-column format.
Ben Bradley is the former executive editor of the Washington Post. His new memoir is called A Good Life. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ben Bradley. He was the executive editor of the Washington Post from 1968 to 1991. Bradley has a new autobiography called A Good Life. In the first part of our interview, we talked about publishing the Pentagon Papers and leading the investigation of Watergate. The Post investigative reporting was behind the downfall of President Nixon. You were good friends of an earlier president, of John Kennedy.
I was.
You lived down on the same block. You became friends before he even ran for president. And you write that because you were already friends and because you had access to him, you were working at Newsweek for the time, as he rose politically, he became, your story. If you were an editor and someone was friends with someone who was president or was running for president, would you let that friend of the politician cover him? Would you have let yourself cover Kennedy?
Yeah, I didn't cover him. I covered him as until he was president, and then after that, I didn't cover him. Mm-hmm. I mean, I covered his campaign. I don't know. Let me tell you this. I'd love to have that problem. I'd love to have a reporter with that kind of access. This said, I would worry a lot about it, and I would discuss it more than we discussed it. There are several things to say about it. First, there's a lot of self-regulatory mechanisms that kick in. One, if you are the reporter in question, you have colleagues who are watching you with an eagle's eye and combing your copy to see if you are carrying water for your friend, the president. You yourself don't want to be accused of that in the history books. And your editors, who love your access, but they don't want to be accused by their colleagues of carrying water for the president. So there are built-in controls to that. My relationship with Kennedy, I would go into the doghouse for months at a time for writing something that he didn't like. But you must understand that reporters who cover politicians are going to develop a relationship with that politician. It can be a good, healthy respect, liking. It can be loathing. In some cases, it could be a physical relationship. And you have to know about that. You have to know it as a reporter. Your editors have to know about it. I think once everybody knows about it, it's easier to control. But there is still this accusation that, the old Joe Blow, he's such a friend of the president's that you can't believe a word he says or something like that.
So what were your rules with him about what was on and off the record?
Well, he would, he knew how I earned my living, and if he didn't want me to run something, he'd say so. And he would say, you can't use that except for a book. I quickly told him that I thought I would write a book.
Which you did,
which
years
I did.
Later?
I think it was 10 years later. It was published in 1974, 10 years after he died. And I had kept notes of, contemporary notes of every conversation I'd had with him, which was, 125 or 150. And I hadn't even looked at them for 10 years. The end of the 10-year period was Watergate, and I was really occupied in doing other things. Also at that time, after Watergate, I was really looking for a change of I wanted to concentrate on something else. Yeah. And I picked up those notes and wrote a book.
You've always said that when you knew Kennedy, you didn't know about the affairs he was having.
I don't. I didn't.
Him. Right. And
I have trouble convincing my peers of that. And I would just ask them to envision the times when I saw Kennedy was almost always with my wife and his wife. And we talked about a lot of things. But one of the things we did not talk about was anybody's affairs.
After your sister-in-law was murdered, you learned from her diary that Kennedy had had an affair with her, with your own sister-in-law. What was your reaction when you found that
Stunned.
Out?
Stunned. I mean, I can still see my wife's expression on her face when she learned that her sister had had this. This diary has been slightly misdescribed. I mean, it is not a long, detailed, factual account of an affair. My sister-in-law was an artist, and it was what artists call a paint book, and filled with swatches of paint and color and descriptions of how that color was achieved and what the painter had in mind. And then in the margins, maybe a dozen times or 13 or 14 times, there were sort of fragments describing a relationship, and it was obviously an affair, and it was obviously with the president.
Now,
no names were ever mentioned.
When you found that out, did that force you to revise your opinions of Kennedy as a man or as a president?
Well, you know, I don't think so. I don't know. I was stunned and by the kind of the magnitude of this proclivity that he had, but whether or not it made him less of a president, less of a man, I'm not prepared to say. I think that when he had an affair with a woman that was also having an affair with a mobster, I think if I had known that, I don't think there's any question that we would have run that, and I think there is a serious question that whether or not he could have survived that.
Survived it as president?
Yeah. Whether or not a casual affair is something that doesn't have to be written about if it doesn't interfere with the presidency, but to have an affair with a gangster's girlfriend shows a penchant for risk that I think probably presidents shouldn't show.
Now, how did your later knowledge of Kennedy's affairs play into your decision-making on how to cover Gary Hart's campaign when it was revealed that he was having affairs?
Well, Gary Hart is kind of challenged and was so overt about it and so frank about it. He was pictured on the lap of this woman on the Monkey Business, the name of the yacht, and kept saying that he never did this kind of thing, and challenged the press to follow him, and of course they did, and they found out about this, and I thought that was tantamount to a lie. And I think America is mixed up about whether this is okay or not. I think the lying is wrong, but the affair per se may be, I think there's room for doubt about that. Would he have been a good president? I think he might have been a very good president.
So your rule of thumb is if there's deceit involved.
Well, that's one route and one rule, and the other is: does it interfere with his
judgment,
behavior? In other words, instead of attending the cabinet meeting, is he off sleeping with somebody, or is he late for meetings because? I think that's a real good subject for consideration, but. The fact that Franklin Roosevelt had a physical relationship with a woman doesn't seem to me to have diminished him as a president in any way.
My guest is Ben Bradley, former executive editor of The Washington Post. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ben Bradley. Let me get to the Janet Cook chapter of your career, which is probably the roughest chapter.
Yes, it was.
Of your editorial career. She was a young reporter at the Post who wrote a story about an 8-year-old heroin addict named Jimmy, who she said was shot up by his mother's lover. And You write in your book, she had top drawer college credentials, she could write like a dream, and she was black, the answer to a modern editor's prayers. But after she got the Pulitzer Prize for this story, she revealed that she lied. Now, she had lied.
She revealed under great pressure.
Under great pressure, yes. Yeah. So she made up the story about Jimmy, the young heroin addict, and she also lied about her credentials.
Yeah, which we should have caught, obviously. But at that time, there was a new law that said that colleges could not release information about students unless they had the specific authority of the student. Janet Cook was too good to be true at a time when we were looking for minority employees. She came along with proven talents. We didn't check with Vassar to find, and had we done so, we would have found out that she spent 1 year at Vassar and did not graduate with all sorts of honors, which would have made us check everything else out. She did not speak all those languages. She did not... play the piano beautifully and, just a thousand things.
Now, how did the story make it into a print, given that it was based on someone who didn't exist? Is fact-checking different, or was fact-checking different for feature stories than for political stories?
Well, probably a little, although I don't think that played much role in it. Here's a woman who we had come to trust, mm-hmm. a woman whom we wanted to believe in, a woman who was really a good writer. That's a beautifully written story. I mean, it was dramatic, but it was beautifully written. And she says that she has befriended a woman who has a lover and an 8-year-old son, and the 8-year-old son is hooked. And we were constantly exploring the dimensions of the drug problem in America and in Washington. It looked like an extraordinary story. And so we asked her to pursue it. She provided details that were stunning, stunning, and there were so many of them, what everybody looked like, what the sofa was, Naugahyde, and what was on the walls and where it was this way. And we wanted to believe it. We wanted to believe it because it was a hell of a story. We wanted to believe it because we wanted her, a black reporter, to be a great success, and she had been a great success. It didn't occur, I think, for me to need to know who Red was. Red was the name of the lover. It would have meant nothing to me or nothing to Red. And it was occurring in a section of town where I was not welcome. And so just little by little by little, it picked up momentum. It got in. And then disaster struck. She won the prize.
If she hadn't won the prize, you think the truth never would have come out?
I don't know. The beginning, it is now claimed that there were lots of suspicions, but certainly none of them had been voiced before.
So what would you do differently now if someone brought you the same story?
Well, I would do two things. One is I would, the real way she got unmasked was when Milton Coleman, her editor, said, take me down to this place, show it to me. And she couldn't do it. In other words, it didn't exist. And he said, he got in a car with her, and he said, now tell me where it is. So we would have done that. She had another story that she was working on, which had involved 10 and 12-year-old prostitutes. And we said, well, already we had said before she was unmasked, let's talk about those people. Let's go see some of them. Beside you, let's us see them. And that story, never matured, as we say, euphuistically.
So did editorial policy change?
Yeah, well, we have a much more elaborate system now of checking references and checking credentials. Incidentally, she had clips of her stories from the Toledo Blade that were remarkable. Mm-hmm. And even after the fact, there was never any question brought up about their authenticity. And the Toledo Blade looked at them very carefully. Once we were confronted with this... with the evidence. I mean, we learned about this because we got a phone call from Vassar College saying, we think there's a little problem. And they had read the publicity release that that Columbia had University had put out in connection with her winning the Pulitzer Prize, in which she had described herself as a graduate of Vassar. And this woman in the dean's office of Vassar said, you know, she's not a graduate of Vassar. And that started at the same time the Toledo Blade was looking into her allegations, that her claim that she had got a graduate degree from the University of Toledo, which she hadn't. And you could see that we had a problem, and we got to, we took her in and really grilled her in a very tough way. And it was some time before she finally admitted it. And the first thing I did was to call up Joseph Pulitzer Jr. And say that this thing had happened, and we were going to return the Pulitzer Prize on the following morning. And then the second thing we did was to assign the Washington Post ombudsman to make a complete, thorough investigation. No holds barred, no information withheld. And our goal was that we wanted the world to know everything there was to know about Janet Cook. And we succeeded, you know. There is no information about Janet Cook in the public domain that we didn't reveal first. And I'm proud of that.
Ben Bradley is my guest, former executive editor of the Washington Post, and he has a new memoir called A Good Life. There's an article called Race in the Newsroom about the Washington Post in the October 2nd edition of the New Republic. And this article by Ruth Shallett says that determined diversity hiring at the Post has provoked an affirmative action backlash, fanning racial tensions among white and black reporters as both groups feel aggrieved and victimized by discrimination. She goes on to write about diversity sensitivity exercises and role-playing for the journalists, that the journalists really felt much too skeptical to participate happily in. And that there are political pressures to promote minorities, and that there's a lot of pressure to have minority news be positive, good news kind of stories. I wonder what your reaction was to that story, if you thought that it was valid.
Well, I'm sure you would understand why my reaction is very strong. The first thing I would do is question the credentials of the New Republic in this area. As Don Graham, the chief executive officer of the Washington Post, said, the New Republic has been looking for a qualified black reporter since 1914. Ruth Shallett herself's credentials are completely suspect, I think. She has been charged and apologized twice for plagiarism. And now, this said, there is an effort has been an effort for 20 years in the Washington Post to increase its minority representation, increase its female representation, and that pressure goes on. It exists. There are people who have resented it. They exist in the city room. There are people who think they didn't get a job because they were the wrong color or the wrong sex. And I don't know how to avoid that. I know that that is the most sophisticated, difficult situation, and that it is always smoldering, always susceptible to a can of kerosene that somebody casually throws in. The Washington Post is a record in hiring minorities is extraordinarily successful. It may not be perfect. It may not be as all that it should be, although it is far better than anyone else's.
What about pressure to write good news stories?
Well, I've been out of the newsroom for 4 years, and one of the criticisms I hear of the Washington Post is that there's so much crime in the Washington Post, and most of that involves black people. So, sure, we like stories that show accomplishment, that show that you know, that the glass isn't always half empty. Sometimes it's half full. Whether that is done too much? I don't know. I mean, in my list of things that are wrong with the newspaper, that's not on it.
You do write in your book, now that I'm retired, I don't miss the administrative meetings about budgets, diversity, and reengineering.
Man, is that, that's the truest line in the book.
That's the worst part about being an editor.
Well, it's endless. I mean, there are days when you didn't get to the newsroom, to the news conference. You didn't get to tomorrow's newspaper until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And, you know, you only had another couple of hours to go. And I think that's wrong. Let me tell you something. I think that being the editor of the Washington Post is tougher now than it was when I was there.
Why?
Well, because there's so much of this going on. I really, this discussions and meetings and process and reengineering, all that stuff. And at the risk of being called a male chauvinist pig or a racist, I think that in my time we got to tomorrow's paper quicker. And we didn't have as good a record as the current paper has on minority hiring or women hiring.
How did you know the time was right for you to retire?
Because I was 70 years old and I had... I felt about what I just said. I felt that I had lost interest in this process stuff. And that stories, the State of the Union messages didn't seem to me as important as they probably should. I mean, in my mind, they blurred with economic messages and they blurred with press conferences and they blurred with... there's a lot of process in Washington. You know, the subcommittee passed today, voted 8-4 to do this, and then the full committee did, and then the same process again in the Senate. And I don't think that furthers much. So I still miss, when a story gets the town by the throat, I just love it.
Ben Bradley is the former executive editor of the Washington Post. His new memoir is called A Good Life. This is Fresh Air.